Welcome to another episode of Pearls of Passage. I'm your host, Ellie Atherton. Today I'm joined by my friend Gail Shopik. You might remember Gail from the very first episode. We talked about lots of aspects of hospice, and today we're just sitting down over coffee, and Gail's going to share some of the things that she feels are important and she would like you to know. So thank you for tuning in. Here we are. I'm here with my friend Gail again. We got our morning coffee. It's the first frost in Kennebunkport. It's a beautiful sunny morning in November. And people will remember Gail from my very first podcast.
Yes.
Thanks for the coffee.
Definitely. My pleasure.
And today we have so many things to talk about. It's probably going to end up being a few podcasts in the end. So we're just going to ramble on today. And I'll turn it into something.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good.
So anything that is important that you want people to learn from your experiences in hospice, that's what we're going to talk about today. The things that, you know, you feel could be improved upon.
It's hard to even figure out how to start exactly, because there are quite a few different areas and many things that I've learned over the years and seen over the years. I mean, I think one of the things that I think is really important that has helped me, myself, is the idea of, and the importance of knowing what a particular person wants, if mm-hmm. they can figure that out for end of life.
Right.
Where do they want to be? Where do they want to be? Who's going to be their primary caregiver?
Yeah.
Who's going to take care of them?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's such, it can be very hard at the end when somebody's declining.
Yeah.
And needs more care than sometimes family, that person or their family even realizes.
Yeah, and it's not a one-person job.
It is not.
And, you know, having hospice is great. But we're in there, you know, we come in as a nurse, and you were the same way. We would spend a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then the LNA might come in for an hour or more to shower, change the bedding. But that leaves a lot of hours in the week, even if we came several times a week.
Right, exactly.
And I think the worries I had about the caregiver issues a lot of times came down to the elderly caregiver giving care to their elderly spouse.
Exactly. And not realizing the physicalness that depending on, I mean, everybody's in a different spot and their strength can change over time.
Right.
So if somebody was admitted to hospice, they were up moving around, they were doing, you know, pretty much able to take care of themselves in the way that they could get up and move around and maybe do their own bathing, etc.
Yes.
It changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not sure how it's going to change.
That's right.
But when it does change and people get weaker, the idea of an elderly caregiver who has been able to do it up until that time now may not be able to do it.
Right. And the LNAs are great. They can come in and help with that. So LNA, licensed nursing assistant, and that's their role, to help with bathing and dressing and sometimes putting up a light lunch or stripping the bedding and washing it, but they can't hang around to wait for it to go through the dryer and dry it because they've got to go on to the next patient. But they also aren't there if there's a crisis like of incontinence. And then here's this elderly caregiver trying to help their spouse during those episodes, which can be really challenging and taxing.
And difficult.
On both, yeah.
I remember a few times when, or we heard stories about, you know, if we were on call, getting a call from a caregiver saying that their person had been incontinent and they couldn't do it and they wanted us to come out right then and there.
Right, in the middle of the night or whenever it was.
And it doesn't always work.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't always possible to do that for them.
Right.
And I think that was one of the things about hospice. the people didn't understand.
Right. Oh, exactly, they all thought that we were moving in.
Exactly.
They heard from their friends. Hospice was so great, and they thought we had come, and someone basically moved into the house and became a 24/7 caregiver. And there are hospices. I learned this from a friend whose family was in Florida, that there are hospices around the country who really take advantage of that continuous care aspect of hospice and just put people in the home 24/7 because they can bill at a higher rate for it. So they would, you know, draw the picture that it was necessary so they could bill Medicare for that continuous care. But what I was hearing from that family is these people aren't really doing, they're sitting on the couch, they're watching television, they're not really giving a lot of care to my parent. And, you know, they called me to say, what's going on? You know, I'm in New Hampshire, but they knew I did hospice. They said, what's going on? What is this? This is what hospice does. So that might be part of what creates the story that hospice moves in.
Right.
But, you know, their story of hospice wasn't a great, it wasn't great. They didn't like that, you know, they felt like it was an invasion of privacy. And so here are the people you're talking about who could really use more help, maybe blocks of time. And, you know, that's not really part of what hospice does.
No, it's not.
And so many people need that greater support in those crisis moments. So, you know, if they have a child who can be right there or can move in, that's great. But how many people can do that?
Right. And for people, for families to know up front that that is not what hospice does.
Mm.
I mean, I did work at one hospice, and part of Medicare hospice benefit, there is this continuous care.
You have to meet a certain criteria, and if you're honestly meeting it, so what I'm saying is this hospice was not honestly using it appropriately, they were abusing it.
Right, and it was sort of time, that benefit was sort of time limited.
Yeah.
And it was also through, it was only through the agencies that actually had the staff.
That's the bigger
problem. To be able to provide that continuous care.
Exactly.
Which I know I worked at one hospice where we tried to do that for a while, but it was impossible to get the staff that would be available because not everybody wants that and not everybody meets the criteria. So you would have staff that either we needed them or we don't.
And that was the issue, exactly. I know that at the agency where we tried to do it, that was the issue because we just couldn't promise that there was going to be work.
Exactly.
And so if you have people who are per diem, and like you said, you need them and you call them, well, they can't just be waiting by the phone. So they've got other per diem jobs and they're not available. So I think that's why the situation in Florida probably happened. They just created a continuous care program, and they probably have a huge census too, so maybe they're able to keep people busy because they can always find somewhere to put them in.
Right, and that sounds like they were sort of misrepresenting pushing the continuous care on people so that they could maintain
keep it
this.
Going.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a vicious cycle and it's not a perfect world. We know that. But, you know, and we're not sitting down today to discourage people from being caregivers or getting hospice, but just to say, you know, try to think about some of these things. Wouldn't that be beautiful? No one does. No. But nobody really wants to talk about it beforehand. Like, even in my family, like, they don't want to talk about, it's seen as like negative, depressing. We don't want to talk about what might happen. We'll just deal with it when it gets here.
Which is difficult in the moment.
It's
stressful to get a diagnosis or to see your family member declining.
And
if you haven't talked about what they want or if they say they want to be home, what's the reality of that?
Right, and you can't expect your family members to just quit their jobs and move in and take care because, right, we would meet all these children who would say, I can't just stop working.
Right.
I want to help my parents, but I can't just stop working and be there, or I live in another state, or I have young children I have to care for. I can't, you know, I can only help a little bit. It gets really complicated.
It does get complicated. And people don't always know up front when they're presented with the hospice option what that means.
Right.
The fact that, like you were saying, that we come into the house intermittently.
Yeah.
We're available on call for sort of crisis situations of symptom management or whatever the problem is, but we don't stay there for hours and hours.
Right.
So to know the reality of the fact that this is what hospice provides, and it's a great benefit because it does provide extra
support,
on many levels from many different types of staff, social worker and spiritual and nurses' aides.
Right, right. Volunteers, chaplain. Yeah, there's
exactly.
a lot to access.
But it's not around the clock.
Mm-mm.
So it would be nice for people to understand that hospice is available, that it's available for, I guess I'm getting stuck here a little bit because frequently people misunderstood the fact that hospice, they thought that hospice was end of life, like in the last 2 weeks.
Right. Because that's so often what it is.
That's what ends up happening.
Yeah, and that's what they're hearing about. Yeah, we had them for the last couple of weeks because of the late referrals. I was surprised when I interviewed Patrick. He said, still the most common length of stay is a day. That's heartbreaking to me after 20 years.
Right.
My short, I mean, it's hospice has been around longer, but in the last two decades, that hasn't really changed. That's just unfortunate.
It is unfortunate.
We're still seeing death as a failure.
Right.
Yeah, that's so, I think it's sad. I'm trying so hard to change it.
And I would like to see that happen as well.
Yeah, how do we do it, Gail? Come on. How do we do this?
I think some education about what hospice actually is, what it provides, and how long it can go on for. And the fact that if we have people come on to service, which we frequently did early, we get to know them and we get to help them figure out what it is they want if they hadn't talked about that and know that already.
Right.
And get to know them and develop a relationship of trust.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I took care of people anywhere from a couple of hours to years. I mean, hospice does have the criteria that when you're admitted, you have to have a terminal diagnosis and a physician that can certify that you have 6 months or less.
Right.
But that's just an admission criteria because we never know.
Right. It's just
how long somebody has.
Prognostication is tricky business. Patients would prove them wrong just out of sheer stubbornness.
Exactly.
Oh, time and again,
times,
right?
We never knew.
No.
It could either be longer or shorter, depending on their physical issues were and how they thought about it.
The patients would say, the doctor said, you know, I'm probably going to live 2 or 3 months, and they made sure they did what the doctor said.
Right.
We had those people, too.
We did.
They were watching the ticking clock, and they'd say, gosh, he said 2 months, and it's coming down to the last couple of weeks. Certain patients really, it was almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. They had told themselves, okay, this is what the doctor says I have left, and this is what we're going to do. And if that's what they wanted, that's fine.
It is.
But we also had those people who wanted to defy those, you know, guesstimates, and my God, sometimes to the point of just suffering. You know, they just were fighting deaths, and their family was watching them become just a skeletal frame, sheathed in skin. They weren't eating, they could barely, it was not pretty. And I always would think, what are you winning here? What are you winning at? But it was their choice again.
Right, and that's the the thing about hospice is to try to get to know somebody well enough to know what their choice is and try to help them and family to get through the process.
Right. Right.
And to also know that hospice is not just the last 2 weeks.
Right.
And to know that hospice is not a death sentence. And we had not a lot, but numbers of people that came onto the service and they might improve or they might become stable enough that we couldn't justify keeping them on and we would discharge them from hospice.
Right. Hospice graduation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they could graduate, and then if they started to decline again and they met the criteria,
come
on
later.
Service, they might come back on service.
Or sometimes I would meet people with cancers who would say, I just learned from my oncologist that there's, you know, more research coming out. So they would discharge from hospice, depending on the outcome of that, you know, they would come back to us later. But I think the other important thing that I'm trying to say is that because referrals are late, education is still important early on about all this preparation. And that's why my next book, which I hope will be out this month, that book is really intended for all the people who don't get hospice. Half the people dying in the U.S. don't have hospice. They don't have all these opportunities you're talking about, even limited. And what do they do?
Right, what do they do?
They have no guidance. They have, at the end of life, they're caring for people at home who are dying. They're going through all of it with no help at all. And I've been meeting these people. And I hear their stories and I think, my God. They had no comfort kit. They had no hospice nurses coming in. And they did it pretty much alone. But they didn't know what to expect at all.
Right.
And that's why the book came out, because I thought, okay, hospice is a great thing, but we still have this issue around avoiding death. So half the country, for whatever reason, doesn't even get to the point of hospice, even for a single day. And so I just thought about things like that families would say to me, oh, you know, I never knew how to change the bed because I couldn't get my husband out of it until the LNAs did it. Wow, I wish I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something in the book, how to change the bedding with a person in it. Or they didn't know how to put a bedpan under and take it out. So the book is not by any means a complete guide, but it's just a starting point for people who suddenly are told your spouse just had a stroke and now you're going to have to care for them at home and they don't know where to begin. Most of the people I met had been in the caregiving role a long time when we came on the scene.
Yeah.
We did get like the diagnoses that came out of the blue that people didn't know, but I feel like more of those were coming from oncology where it was an advanced stage cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And they were told, you know, you're at a point where we really don't have treatments. You're kind of beyond because it's so widespread, or it's pancreatic and it's so advanced, or, you know, and we would have them a short time. The other ones were people who had been in treatments for years and doing the care, as you talked about, with them slowly declining.
Yeah.
But they didn't have any help.
Right. They didn't have any help. And then if hospice came in, they started to get some help.
Yeah.
Which was beneficial. But on the other hand, I think people don't realize, even with hospice, which can be a great help, if you don't have that extra family to come in take breaks and to assist you with the physical care, depending on how it is, that there are options of hiring extra if you have the financial ability to do that. But even that takes coordination and resources.
Right.
You know, which hospice, we frequently did help people to figure that out.
Right. And some, you know, the social workers can be just like magical in moments like that where they can access resources that no one knew were available, or grants, or even for people who don't have the means. There are, in New Hampshire, we're one of the states that has the program where the family can be a paid caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
Not all states have that, but that can be a really beautiful option that can help. It's not huge payment.
Yeah.
So if someone has a high-paying job, it's not going to be equal equal swap out. But it was an option for a lot of families.
Mm-hmm.
So having the social worker to explore those different options and help you work through all the documentation that comes with that, because it's never easy and straightforward, is really valuable.
It is valuable.
And so that's another great aspect of hospice. You know, the social worker is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Connecting and helping with planning, like advanced directives, are they in place? Have you thought about funeral planning?
Yes.
All those things that we don't really want to talk about but are so important, because the few families I met who did nothing at all were very, at the moment of death, where it's so emotional, the reality of it is hard to accept. Now you have to decide all these important aspects of what's going to happen now.
Yeah.
Which funeral home? How will they be buried? Where will they be buried?
Yeah.
In a moment of great emotion, that's a huge thing to ask of someone, to make big decisions when you don't know how you're going to go forward.
So right. It's difficult for family and difficult for, you know, the staff that go out at the time of death. To try to help figure out in the moment.
Yeah.
Especially if it's like in the middle of the night. Do you know which funeral home do you want? Do you
have
the... Exactly. Do you know what kind of arrangements?
Mm.
Do you even have the money? Did they have a death
benefit? Right.
I can remember one family that didn't know what to do, and they didn't have the financial resources.
Yeah.
So even in the moment, trying to call the social worker... to say, is there any, sometimes cities would have some funds for burial in a particular financial situation for somebody in their community.
Right.
But all that's a lot to figure out in the moment.
Right.
In the moment of extreme grief at the time of death.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right.
Yeah. It helps to talk about it before, as hard as it is for some to talk about. It really helps because... after someone dies, I learned from the families, they really just wanted to do what that person wanted. But when they didn't know, then they second-guessed every decision they made.
And sometimes there was differences of opinion within family members about what to do. That adds another level of complication and stress.
Yeah.
And when people have differences of opinion.
And families divided over this stuff. Saw that often about what dad would have wanted or mom would have wanted, and they didn't agree.
It's a challenge, definitely.
So, you know, you're doing your loved ones a favor if you plan.
Mm-hmm.
That's the message I keep trying to get out. You are caring for the patient, but you're also caring for the emotions of the family and trying to help them. We take it so to heart that we want to do it well. And it's not always easy to do it well for some people who don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
So they don't want to hear about it and be prepared. And we used to use the Blue Book.
Yeah, exactly. The book that kind of gives the... not that you can say everybody's process is usual, but...
I agree. The book doesn't give... what's going to happen to everyone in the order it's going to happen.
But it gives you an idea of what you might see.
So it breaks it into, if I remember right, like in the months before and the weeks before and the days and the hours. And
it just gives you a general idea of what you might expect.
Right.
But it was too hard for some people to look at.
Yeah.
Some people were open to it. And I think that was helpful.
Well, the feedback I would get from people who would be open to the conversation or open to reading the book would be that they were glad, because then they weren't afraid when they saw, for example, the breaks in the breathing that came at the end of life. It didn't scare them. Where the people who hadn't got really scared because they said, we didn't expect it and we didn't know what was happening. And sometimes, you know, if caregivers aren't given enough information, they don't know if they're doing things right or wrong. And every caregiver wants to get it right.
They do.
So I had recently, I knew of someone who was caring for their dad, helping their mom. And they had hospice, which was good. They said it was very good. But they, I don't think they had been told about the how the last hours or minutes would be and how the breaks in the breathing would be and how sometimes people at the end kind of take, like, I used to call them guppy breaths.
Right, yes.
That was, like, the best way to describe it. Like, it's like they're not gasping, but some people look like they're just taking in that last. Once you see it a lot, you know they're just taking in those last breaths, and that's normal and expected. But if you don't know that and you've never seen it, then it could you could be worried, and you might think you have to do something about it. And that's what happened. So they thought when in the last minutes when he was doing that, they wanted to help him. So they tried to give a nebulizer treatment, and he was pushing it away. He didn't want it. They tried to put oxygen. He didn't want it. So he was still in a place where he could actually respond and push it away. And so they took his cue and stopped trying. But then it was, you know, a minute or two later that he passed away. And they were upset because they felt like they had annoyed him in his last minutes of life. And when they told me that, it was heartbreaking because I said, you know what? He knew what was happening to him. He knew what you were doing was a loving gesture. You were trying to help. You didn't understand that he was about to step away. And you just thought he needed help to be more comfortable. So don't carry that as like a mistake or something, because you didn't do anything wrong. But, you know, what was hard for them is that they felt like, you know, they had upset him in those last minutes. And I just felt sad that had they known, they might not have intervened, right? They would have said, oh, this is, he's getting close because now, look, he's doing what they said he would do in those last minutes. That's why I think education is so important.
It's important. Or even in the support, to know that, you know, either they, in that situation, that it might be that they felt like they had annoyed him, or maybe because he didn't have the oxygen, they called it caused his death.
Yeah, that's not true.
I mean, that's
true.
Another thing
Good
that
point.
People think.
Yes.
At people have thought, and even people that take care of people
medical
sometimes,
people too,
you know, the example of the morphine, you know, the idea, I don't want to be the one to give the last dose.
Oh my gosh, I know.
And to know that that giving that dose of morphine might make that person comfortable enough to be able to let go.
Right, to be able to relax and let go of their
and
physical
body. And that
they
didn't cause the death.
No.
That they actually possibly facilitated.
Facilitated comfort.
Or holding the morphine because they don't want, they're so afraid of causing somebody's death.
We saw that a
which
lot.
Which just causes more discomfort, or leads to more discomfort for that particular person.
Right.
So education, I think, is really important.
Yeah.
And I found it difficult at times. I think the thing that was most difficult was to have an idea when you're taking care of a patient and trying to support family of what might be helpful, but that that person or their family didn't want to do that, and to let that go.
Yeah.
Because you're really there to support
That's right.
people the way they want to be supported. You're not there for promoting your own idea of, you know, to be the, you know, super person that comes in and has all the answers.
And we don't, because there's no one straight path.
Right.
And you'd put it out there, and again, sometimes you would leave that blue book and no one would ever pick it up. Other times they'd read it. I mean, we even had the families, remember, who would say, don't talk, don't say you're from hospice, turn your badge over, don't tell them they're dying. Talk about
challenging.
That was difficult. It was.
To be from hospice and not be able because to not be feel comfortable being able to be up front.
Well, with, you'd have to temper everything that came out of your mouth. It was just really challenging.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't talk in the way that you would normally talk with people. And I would still try to say to the families, they know what's going on. They know they're dying.
So true.
And the family would say, no, no, they really don't. Don't upset them. Don't upset them. And I would think, gosh, I wonder if it's more upsetting to be a dying person and have no one talk about the fact that you're about to leave this world forever and have any closure. Is that really better? Because are we honoring, did they have a chance to honor them and say, I'm so glad we were married for all these years, or give them the opportunity to say, thank you for being a great wife or a daughter? There's none of that. And to me, that seemed like a huge injustice for everyone.
Yeah.
But you're right. We had to honor it because that's where they were.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one young couple, he was in that program, we called it the Bridge Program, advanced illness for the people who were still in treatments and really needed to be in hospice but didn't want to give up the treatment. So we were allowed to go visit them as hospice nurses, not treating them like a hospice patient because they didn't want it.
Yes.
But they needed a hospice nurse expertise in the situation to pain and symptom management
exactly.
purposes.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, what can I do? How do I do a good job in this situation? Because I feel like I'm not doing a good job. Because I can't tell them.
You were feeling that way because?
Because I couldn't talk about things. Like I remember saying to the wife, do you want to know what's coming? And she said, no. And I said, okay. So I had to honor that. And as I saw him getting worse, I would have days where I would say to him, do you really want to go in for another treatment today? Because it seems like you're just getting knocked down even more after every treatment. And he would say, I have no other choice. I have to keep getting treatments. And I'd say, well, you know you can always stop them if you want. And I wouldn't use the word hospice because they didn't want to hear it. But I would always say, it's your choice. So if you're feeling really lousy from the treatments at any time, you can say you want to stop. And I'll make sure that we keep you comfortable. We're always going to do our best to try to keep you comfortable.
So you did a good job with supporting them where they were at.
Well, I don't know.
Is what I have to say, because you can't. I never felt like I could make people. You can't make people be where you would like to see them. And I know I did the Bridge Program, too, for patients. That was part of my caseload at one of the agencies. And I found it beneficial at times to get to know this person and their family.
Yeah.
And when people started to decline, there were times when it made it easier to bring up hospice when they were ready.
Yes,
And to really explain what that was about. But I also had difficult situations. I mean, I can remember one woman in her 50s who was an incredibly intelligent woman who was bedridden. She had extreme, her cancer had invaded her entire body. She was barely eating. She was very frail.
I think I remember her. Was she in Durham?
She was.
I remember, yeah. That's a good example.
So I would go there as an advanced illness nurse, and I had to do things like change her, IV line, which was, and she had wounds that had to be tended to, and she also had breathing difficulties because she had fluid that was accumulating around her lungs. She would go by ambulance to the hospital to have that drained.
Right.
And whenever we talked about, which she wouldn't allow talking about end of life, but when I attempted to do it in the beginning, she told me that she felt like any talk about hospice or end of life was giving up.
Right. A lot of people
see
it that way.
And she did not want to give up.
Yeah.
So,
and that's their choice. That, yeah.
Honor that until that last day.
Mm-hmm.
When she ended up not ever coming on hospice, but
yeah,
the benefit of my going in there.
Right. That's as close as you can get.
And her caregiver was her mom and another friend or paid caregiver. And being able to tell them when she was looking like she had a day or two left to live.
Right.
And could still speak a little bit.
Mm.
To educate them about what was happening.
Right.
And to ask her, you know, I remember that last day I went in, I was talking to her mom and the other caregiver and found out that she had been on hospice maybe for one day, like a couple months ago. So they had a comfort kit in the house.
Oh, thank God.
And then talking to this patient and saying, I knew that she had had a DNR, but she ripped it up in the past.
Interesting.
And having to talk to her. I mean, mm-hmm. I went to the house. I talked to the caregiver. She didn't want to talk about it at that time, and she was too weak. Mm. So I left the house not feeling comfortable with this whole situation.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
And calling my manager at the time and talking with her about it. And she suggested that I go back to the house and just have a discussion with the patient about the fact that if she was not a do not resuscitate,
right,
and she was, you know, declining and having symptoms, that we needed to recommend that she go to the hospital.
Right.
And maybe call 911.
Right.
To take her to the hospital.
Yeah.
So she could get the care she said she wanted.
She still wanted it.
No, and I went back and talked to her, and we were able to have a discussion. And I would say, this is what I think is happening. It looks like you're getting close to death. Do you want to go to the hospital? And she said no.
So she signed. She wanted the DNR again. And did you have orders to pronounce, too? Because that's the tricky part.
I think we had to get that at the last minute. There was really no time to get a DNR, quote-unquote,
and as long as the family knew what to do, it was okay.
Right.
Right.
So then
That's an important point.
The whole, you know, education, it could be out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you have the comfort kit. This is what you want. We're going to get an order to go out to the house and pronounce once she has died.
Right.
And to give that family the support.
Because otherwise, if hospice isn't involved and the orders to pronounce aren't there and there's no DNR posted, if the patient dies, then the coroner has to be involved. And the nurse can't pronounce without the order. So it's a whole different process that goes on. And that's another part of how planning ahead really helps the family. So like the young man and woman I was talking about, I had the orders to pronounce because he was doing so poorly when he came on, but he was on for months.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that last weekend with him because I was working and he had started his dying process. And you could hear the terminal secretions. And she didn't want to talk about it. I tried to open the conversation that I think this is what's happening with both of them. And they got scared. It was like deer in the mm-hmm. headlights. And I said, if you want to go on hospice, we can. We'll support you and keep you home and keep you comfortable. And I think Monday morning they called the oncologist and he went in and that oncologist didn't recognize what a dying patient looked like and admitted him because he thought he had, you know, a bronchitis or something going on. And I'm like, bronchitis?
Oh, no.
And so he was treated in the hospital.
Wow.
Yep, treated and they sent him home. And I think it was during that visit in the hospital that the oncologist said, we shouldn't give you any more chemo. And so that closed the door for him, for the patient. And so I went and I admitted him when he came home from the hospital. And admitted him. And he died the next day.
So was he wasn't admitted to hospice?
one day. I mean, maybe not even 24 hours. So when he came home from the hospital after being treated for quote-unquote bronchitis, but he was really in his dying process, it was terminal secretions, that the oncologist just didn't recognize as that because they're trained to just keep people alive, you
yes,
know?
Yes, no, I know.
So, you know, and we did it the way they wanted to do it. Right, that's the
that
point.
The patient needed to hear that before from, they were willing mm-hmm. to be admitted to hospice. They needed to yeah. hear that there was nothing left to do.
But where was his quality of life in all this? I often wondered, what would his quality of life have been like if he hadn't, because his quality of life was horrible.
I think that's so true, and that's another big decision.
Yeah, and we saw so many people who stopped the chemo treatments and were able to have quality of life for a length of time before they died.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes I think quality of life, because they didn't have the chemo with the side effects.
Right.
Which were, yeah.
So many people would say, had I known the side effects, I never would have done the treatments. People who had radiation, say, I remember a woman who had radiation for throat cancer, and then she could never eat again. Mm-hmm. She had to have liquids.
Yeah.
You know, nausea, vomiting, so many symptoms that just made life unpleasant. And they would say, had I known, I would have rather lived a month because I didn't feel that bad before the treatments.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Treatments too. Sometimes treatments are the, you know, the thing that make you feel worse or make the quality
yeah.
of life less.
And I understand that when you're standing in that moment of being told you have cancer, you can take treatments that will elongate your life by 6 months or whatever, or you can do nothing. And they usually tell them if you do nothing, you'll die sooner, because it's always that the treatments will elongate your life. The discussion of quality of life, I don't believe, is often in the mix. Like, you're having no symptoms now, and if you don't have treatments, we'll just work to make sure you stay comfortable if you start having pain. Or I just don't feel like it's being presented like that.
And I think that that's the possibility of what hospice can offer to people and their families.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that. Really great symptom management. But what we're trying to do in these conversations is diminish fears so there's more opportunity to die peacefully.
Yes. And I've learned that I've had lots of experiences, wonderful experiences with family, and I've learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate the fact that you're doing this and hoping that people will, you know, be able to listen.
Get comfortable.
Exactly.
With this subject.
Exactly.
Thank you, Gail. We'll sit down and talk again.
No, thank you, Ellie.
It's always fun to sit down and talk with my friend Gail. We talked for 2 hours on this morning, and I actually have 2 more episodes at least that will come out of that conversation. So thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. And remember, life offers you endless possibilities. You simply need to be open to them. Here's to a good life and a good death. Have a great week.